Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, Managing Director of Mill Creek Financial Partners.
Hello, and welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. I have yet another great show for you focused on the volunteer state and our nation today, with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest A.J. DePriest with Tennessee Liberty Network. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View Tennessee podcast, visit us on Amazon Music or Spotify and subscribe. As of today, now on Apple iTunes. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And a heartfelt thank you to you for listening. All right. Founded in January 2021, Tennessee Liberty Network is an independent Tennessee-based think tank comprised of 28 volunteer researchers who live within the state's borders. Tennessee Liberty Network does not have a public membership, does not raise or accept funding, does not have a bank account, does not have a public-facing website, is not a registered 501 type organization, does not have a federal tax ID number, is not part of any other organization, and is not instructed by any organization or individual on what to research or what outcomes are produced. Tennessee Liberty Network only follows money and evidence to factual and documented conclusions. Tennessee Liberty files fair use copyrights for each paper to be used in the public domain and encourages the public to include footnoted references as evidence. This is no longer anecdotal information nor hyperbole. It is not the opinion of Tennessee Liberty Network nor its members. Their mission is to equip the public with fact and evidence-based information regarding what is occurring in U.S. healthcare and education systems. One people, one fight for liberty. Hello, Mrs. DePriest. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Thanks for asking. You and Tennessee Liberty Network, a small independent Tennessee think tank, you were involved in the first Vanderbilt medical controversy before the current most recent performing gender transition surgeries on minors blow up. Then 7-month-old baby Austin Stoll was denied a heart transplant because of the concerned parents refused the vaccine. Let's hope the new heart wasn't vaccinated and has myocarditis, but tell us about that journey, would you?
Oh gosh, baby August. Oh, he was such a cutie and he was such a little fighter, but we were contacted by the mom initially. Would just help, one, getting introduced to lawmakers who might intercede on their behalf, and to arrange some media coverage for their story. And we were very careful, of course, not to incite anyone to lash out at the pediatrics unit or the other hospital departments. It was only the transplant doctor that was giving them trouble. So we didn't want any of the good people at the hospital, and there are some good people there, for them to be under attack in any way. And the family.
Vanderbilt Medical Center we're talking about, right?
Yeah, Vanderbilt, the children's hospital. The transplant doctor was the biggest problem. He was insisting that this little baby get these vaccinations, but baby August, you know, came into the hospital with some health problems, and his little body just really wasn't strong enough, his parents believed, to handle a dozen childhood vaccinations. And it should be the parents' choice. So our role in this was to simply, you know, find some lawmakers who would intercede, and we did. And they made phone calls, but it was to no avail, because Vanderbilt is like a petulant teenager and they do whatever Vanderbilt wants. And ultimately, the family had to concede to the vaccinations because, it just came down to a very critical situation where little baby August needed that heart, and, without it, he was going to die. And so they had to risk everything. And, last time I heard, baby August was doing great and the family is doing well, and everything worked out. We've been involved in several cases where it didn't work out, and not just for babies, but for adults, for all ages, all over the country, people being denied being on the transplant list and receiving transplants because they wouldn't get the COVID shot. Yeah. Now, baby.
I mean, the saddest thing is science, real science, not political science or the science of making money, showed kids didn't get or transmit COVID. So why would a hospital filled with scientists and MDs deny a treatment to a baby that had zero risk but would die without the transplant? And I'm glad to hear he's doing well. I'm surprised.
Baby August didn't have to get the COVID shot. It was all the other childhood vaccinations that they wanted him to get all at once, because he was only 7, 8 months old. And because he had so many other health problems, he hadn't received all of his childhood vaccinations. And those were the shots that the pediatrician, that the transplant surgeon was pushing for. But it wasn't the COVID shot for baby August. But all the other people who we've tried to help are mostly people who were denied because they wouldn't get the COVID shot. And one man here in Nashville, this was unbelievable. They wouldn't give this man a transplant because his wife wasn't vaccinated with the COVID shot. And they didn't want this older man getting a transplant and then going home and having his wife take care of him. And can you believe that? I mean, that is ridiculous.
Well, actually, I can now, because the hospitals for the longest time have been doing these things where they wouldn't allow visitation rights to spouses, even with power of attorney, because they wouldn't be vaccinated. And then they weren't able to look at the patient to make sure they weren't getting the remdesivir, or they weren't being put on a ventilator, or they were just treated well. And this is all ages, even 60, 70, 80, 90-year-old people. So it doesn't surprise me that the hospital's been acting very badly in the era of COVID.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, they've gone back to the dark ages. You know, the Hippocratic Oath does not exist in U.S. hospitals today. It's just,
and baby August wasn't your first activation into standing up for what's right. What did get you into this arena?
It's been a long time, actually. We had several people call us in early 2021, and we've been hearing throughout 2020 that there were things about the hospitals, that there were, some similarities in how they were treating patients that were unlike anything that you've ever heard of in hospitals before. Patient rights being completely denied, families not having access, even people with medical power of attorney not being able to be with their family, being given medications and devices without patient consent, those kind of things. And so when 2021 came along, and I formed Tennessee Liberty Network, and we started researching the money from the CARES Act. That's when we discovered in early 2020, the CARES Act basically weaponized several agencies, HHS, the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, the NIAID, which is Fauci's little criminal organization.
Beefed them.
It was funding those organizations, and one of the organizations that it was weaponizing was CMS. That's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And in early 2020, CMS released a set of waivers. I think they're called 1135 waivers, and they were all regarding hospitals and how they were allowed to basically just throw patient rights out the window. And it gave hospitals permission to do these things.
Walk me through this a little bit, because I haven't been following it, you know, line by line. But wasn't there, so there was the CARES Act, but then there was ESSRL-3. The third one was the one that had the most teeth in it that caused these problems. Is that about right? Like, the CARES Act had been around a while.
Yeah.
It was fine. We were bailing out hospitals. We were helping people live, I guess, in a pandemic. But then it became very political, and the third one had the strings attached that really messed with our liberties. Is that about right?
Almost. There are two different issues. There's the medical issues, and then there's the education issues. So for healthcare, the CARES Act is where all the really horrible things started. And that's where all of the CMS waivers allowed hospitals to deny rights, to kick families out, to give patients medication without consent, to put them on ventilators without consent. The CARES Act is the killer there. That's the
and
big
it,
one.
And it grew from $20 billion to $200 billion over that time?
That's the education part.
That's the education one. Okay, so we'll talk about that second. Let's talk about the hospitals first.
Yeah, so the CARES Act is really where all that started. And the CRRSA Act in December of 2020, also signed by Trump, that refunded a lot of that money going to hospitals. But there were a lot of things that hospitals were getting bloated reimbursements for. Like, for instance, hospitals through the CARES Act, through the first appropriation of the CARES Act, they were getting per COVID admission rates. Like for Tennessee, I believe it was
$166,000. And Nebraska was $379,000, and West Virginia, $471,000, and North Dakota, $309,000.
So for every
per COVID patient, right?
Yeah. And so
and with those strings were remdesivir and the ventilator and PCR tests. So it was just a money-making opportunity.
Yeah. So the NIH protocols, NIH/CDC protocols, were the ones that issued the guidelines for hospital treatment of COVID. And those were the ones that had remdesivir and baricitinib and all of those terrible sedatives and the ventilators. And all of that was part of the NIH protocols, and hospitals were ordered to follow those NIH protocols to the letter, because the big reimbursements came from those protocols only.
And Medicare, right? The money was Medicare money.
Right.
And isn't that also where they buried ivermectin and HCQ by listing it as unusable? The NIH did, even though the FDA.
The funny thing is that in the first several months of the NIH protocols had ivermectin and HCQ, and they slowly phased it out of the NIH protocols because people were using that to tell doctors and hospitals, hey, it's right here in your protocols, you can use it. But they kept saying, oh, there's not enough studies to prove that it's safe. But, you know, remdesivir, for some reason, well, I know the reason, it was money, but they would only use that, and they would tell families, we can't use any other protocol. And we all know this is insane, because when in history did anybody ever use one specific protocol to treat a disease? I mean, here's the thing. There is a page at the end of the introduction of the NIH protocols that clearly says that doctors should look at and use other medications and treatments, including, things like ivermectin. It doesn't say ivermectin, but
that's page 33 of the NIH protocol, as a matter of fact. That's experimental drugs and off-label. Yeah.
Right. And the very last sentence of that introduction says that nothing in the NIH protocols is mandated, and it should be up to the patient and the doctor which course of treatment to take.
You know, that is what they call a liability clause. So they are not held responsible, because they told all the medical providers that actually at the very end, it's not mandatory.
That's right. And the problem, though, is that the PREP Act, which we know is what covers is the liability coverage for hospitals and doctors and pharmacies that employ what they called covered countermeasures. And the covered countermeasures under the PREP Act, which is the legal liability document, covers everything related to COVID. It covers the remdesivir, pretty much everything in the NIH protocols, but also the COVID shots. If it related to COVID, it's covered under the covered countermeasures, and doctors and hospitals and pharmacies can't be sued for employing those, even for
injury. They've been using that for everything. Yeah, they've been hiding behind the PREP Act for everything. If a nurse puts an extra hole in your arm because he missed a vein, and you say, hey, I'm infected, I'm suing, they say, oh, PREP Act, PREP Act. I mean, they're hiding behind that.
Yeah, if they can slap a COVID label on it, then it's covered under the PREP Act. They've got to slap a COVID label on it, because anything that's covered under covered countermeasures has to be related to COVID.
And back to the hospitals, terrible. I think it was July 17th, 2020 that the HHS, they gave additional funds, but only for COVID cases. If you had 161 or more cases, you get $50,000 each. And the hospital or the hospital would be shut. Do you know about that? Is that accurate?
I haven't heard that one. Yeah, I mean, well, that might have come from a different, maybe from the CRRSA appropriation. No, that would have been after.
It was HHS, and it was way back in July 20. I mean, the real question is, whatever happened to the Hippocratic Oath, the Nuremberg Code, and informed consent and parental consent? It's all
the CMS waivers completely gave hospitals and doctors and pharmacies permission to waive all patient rights.
I mean, did you know that tomorrow? Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. What would have been absolutely unheard of before COVID was common everyday practice after January of 2020. I mean, I keep telling people, you know, before COVID, the things that we've seen, people could have sued and ripped the funding guts out of these hospitals. Absolutely. But because of the PREP Act and because of the protocols and the CMS waivers, people are just stuck. They've lost loved ones. There are people who survived and they're just gravely injured, and they will never, ever be able to sue. There's a little caveat there, though, and that's
fraud.
The public health emergency is really important to talk about, because the public health emergency really drives everything. It was signed in January of 2020 by Trump, and it's been renewed every 3 months. And our Congress voted to end it in early March, 48 to 47. And it passed, and then it went to Biden. And instead of signing it into law, he didn't. And then he renewed the PHE at the end of April. And I think he might have just renewed it, or it's coming up. What's the date today? The 19th. I think he just renewed it again, but every 3 months. And the PHE is really tied to everything. When the PHE is in effect, then these big reimbursements that go to hospitals to cover all of this behavior that's going on, all of the NIH protocols, all those big reimbursements get paid. When the PHE ends, those big hospital reimbursements stop. When the PHE ends, then all of the testing kits, all of the COVID testing kits that are all over the place, those go away. It says so right on the box. You can see it. Those are produced under emergency use authorization as long as there's a public health emergency. As soon as the PHE ends, all those COVID tests goes away. As soon as the PHE ends, all the money to schools stop. As soon as the PHE ends, all the money going to businesses to mandate the shots stop. And most importantly, if the PHE ends, the PREP Act coverage ends. And that's why we're seeing this push right now to get the COVID shot on the childhood vax schedule, because once that happens, then it doesn't matter if the PHE ends and the PREP Act liability coverage ends.
It's not an emergency anymore. It's just a mandated thing. And actually, the CDC is voting tomorrow. We're recording this on Thursday, the 19th. Tomorrow, the 20th, they're voting to permanently shield Pfizer from vaccine lawsuits and put COVID on that list for schools to mandate, which is another windfall for Moderna and Pfizer, who already reaped hundreds of billions of dollars. So,
that's why the push.
Stop that, right?
That's why they want to push this right now, because if the public health emergency ends, then it's not going to matter, because once it's on the childhood vax schedule, no one will ever be able to sue for damages related to this so-called vaccine.
Funny how they use the quote law to protect themselves to do criminal actions.
Yeah, and then, you know, that this has been going on for decades. I mean, you know, this is what we know about government, is that they write laws to protect themselves, to do dastardly things to their citizens. And it's, you know, the embodiment of tyranny that we see every day now. And it's so commonplace, we're not even shocked by it anymore. We should be, but why? Because every day it's just worse and worse. But one other note about the PHE is that this arrangement with the WHO to come into countries and basically take over their health care, it is in effect as long as a country is under a public health emergency. So when Biden went and met with the WHO and allegedly gave away our sovereignty as a nation and as individuals to the WHO to take over our healthcare, that arrangement is only valid. To me, it's not valid anyway, because I'll never comply no matter what they do, but, and neither should anybody else. But as long as that PHE is in effect, the WHO thinks it has control over our healthcare system. So if there's any other pandemic, then the WHO can just move into the United States and make healthcare decisions for our country.
Well, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
So transparency is always an issue for digging into these things, and you are a researcher. How has your research found Tennessee government in terms of transparency and ease of following the money?
Tennessee is easier than some other states, for sure. Now, we know in the CARES Act and the CRRSA Act and the ARP Act, there are really powerful clauses in there about transparency and what should be publicly available. And it doesn't say it should be easy to find. It just says it has to be publicly available, either on, you know, this website or that website. So it's been very difficult to find for Tennessee, but it's there and we found it. And but it's been harder in other states because they're just not compliant with those clauses. And if people don't call them out and force them to comply, I mean, they want to force us to comply. So we should definitely call them out to comply with these transparency clauses as well. Yeah. So Tennessee has actually been pretty easy, and I don't think they wanted to be transparent. We're looking into some issues with VAERS right now with Tennessee, and we're finding that VAERS reporting has not been done adequately or appropriately. And
some say that it's undercounted by 30. Some say it's undercounted by 100. I think it was Harvard that said 100. So if we're seeing 30,000, it could be actually 300,000 or more.
we're finding that some of the VAERS reports have taken over 200 days to be reported.
Oh.
Yeah. And so a lot of...
I've heard it's very onerous. So the doctors don't really have the time to sit back and fill all that in. So I can see it being late, but that sounds very late.
This is a white paper we're developing with another couple of people who have some very interesting information about VAERS in Tennessee that shows that Tennessee has had the most COVID shot deaths and injuries than any other state.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And we have evidence of that. I'm working with this group. And so that's the next white paper that we're working on. And we're hoping that we can really do something with that. But there are two other states who are also in that top three. And it's Tennessee, Kentucky, and South Dakota. Strange.
I wonder if their compliance is
they're
better.
The most conservative states.
Yeah. Well, Kentucky's kind of half and half. You know, they have kind of a leftist governor, but it's, I think we've, you know, seen some similarities in batches and from the COVID shots between the three states, but the VAERS reporting.
It'd be interesting to hear. I'd be interested to read your paper because either they're more compliant than the other states, meaning they're telling them the truth, or they're under some other guise that could be a scrutiny, you know, and you're all over the federal grant money. Yeah. Can't wait. What else are you looking into right now?
Well, I mean, after we started looking into the hospital things and getting involved with, you know, trying to rescue people out of hospitals and getting family in to be with hospitals, we were looking at, you know, the federal money going to schools from the CARES Act. And ESSER-1 money came out of the CARES Act, and it was a lot, but not enough to really, you know, be concerned about, because most of the money, first of all, there were no real strings attached to it other than just annual reporting. There were no really terrible requirements that states and districts had to comply with. Most of the money was really meant to help states come up to speed with remote learning, because a lot of states and many, many hundreds of districts across the country didn't have remote learning capabilities. And so when they closed schools in 2020, I mean, kids really suffered. They had, that's when the worst of the learning loss occurred. And so, you know, the CARES Act released ESSER-1, and that helped. It's important to note that that the CDC released a report in December of 2020 saying that, let me find it here, that every school in America could open, safely reopen for $25 billion. That was their estimate for safely reopening schools. So the ESSER-1 money was $13.2 billion, and it spread across the states. And then ESSER-2, hey, you, knock it off over there, my dog.
Cute dog.
The ESSER-2 money came out in the CRRSA Act, which was an appropriation of the CARES Act, and it released ESSER-2, and that was $54.3 million.
Billion.
Yeah, billion dollars. Sorry, billion dollars. And that also didn't have any strings attached other than annual reporting. But in March of 2021, Biden signed the ARP Act. And the ARP Act released another $122 billion to public schools. That was ESSER-3 money. But here's where things get tricky. So Biden signed the CRRSA Act in, let me get the date here. So March 11th, he signed the ARP Act. Okay. And two-thirds.
American Rescue Plan, right?
Yeah, yep. Two-thirds of that $122 billion went out to states. Two-thirds. Not all of it. Not like all of it, like the ESSER-Money 1, ESSER-2, all those, they weren't split up. So we started asking ourselves, you know, why is this money split up? So March 24th, you know, just about 10 days after the ARP Act was signed, two-thirds of that big pile of money went to states. Then on April 22nd, about a month later, the interim final requirements were added to the ARP Act in the Federal Register. And that's where we found all of those really awful requirements, the universal masking, the isolation, the quarantine, the testing, the
physical distancing,
and not just that. Yeah. Social distancing, and not just that, but also all the social emotional learning and all the mental health requirements. Those were all part of those interim final requirements. And with that, templates went out to all the states and every district. And there were four plans that every district had to complete, and the state had to complete a template for a state plan showing how they were going to comply with these requirements. And they had to submit that plan, and then within 30 days, then they got the final third. So
So Memphis, I believe, got $750 million to prove that they were meeting those requirements of tracing and quarantining and masking. And and I have a letter here from the United States Department of Education to Penny Schwinn, the Commissioner of Education in Tennessee, saying that we are not, as a state, compliant with some of these things, and that they're going to take some of that money back. Well, is this all the part of the same pocket of strings attached?
Yeah. So what happened was our governor, our state ESSER-3 plan that Penny Schwinn signed and submitted, and in that state plan, there is a signature box in the first couple pages, and it says very clearly, by signing, the state agrees to comply with all ARP Act and ESSER requirements. She signed it, and in assurances section at the end of that that plan, you can see what those requirements are. They lead back to the interim final requirements, the masking, the social distancing, the testing, the vax clinics, the social emotional learning, the mental health, all of that. That's what she committed to with her signature. So,
and ESSRL is, what does that stand for?
ESSER. It's the emergency, it's the elementary and secondary schools emergency relief money.
Okay.
ESSER.
And that grew to $200 billion in this process from what you said, $16 billion to start with no strings.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money. Unless some of these schools hardly have any. So that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And so what did Governor Lee or Jack Johnson or any of these folks do about this when it's sort of an infringement on, well, it's not sort of, it's an infringement on state rights that never would have existed if there wasn't a Department of Education or maybe a Common Core where the federal government is reaching down into states to dictate what happens in schools. What are those guys doing?
Well, our governor really surprised us because about a month after our state ESSER 3 plan was approved by the Department of Education, Governor Lee signed an executive order that stated parents can decide whether to mask their kids or not. So that happened on August 16th. August 18th is when they got that letter that you were just talking about, where it informed them that they were in violation of their ARP interim final requirements. That's that memo that you just mentioned. And if you notice at the end of that memo, the language is really important here. It says that the Fed is going to monitor Tennessee's federal fiscal requirements.
Yep.
Very interesting language there.
And exactly what they did to the Seattle Police Department when they put them under that mandate.
Well, and that's what they did to Arizona, too. You know, the Biden administration weaponized
for immigration.
Yeah. Well, they went after Arizona to take back COVID relief money because of their laws that they passed saying that they weren't going to mask kids. So they actually
went back
after
all the federal money. It's not worth it. It's
definitely
not worth it.
Well, we tell
you know what I was amazed to see, too, is that I don't know if people know this, but school boards where people go and they yell and scream and we see it on the TV on Fox News or whatever, and they say, you know, you guys are not doing what you're supposed to do. They don't have any choice in the matter. That ESSRL stuff, that is the law. And so these board members, don't even need to have board members anymore.
Yeah. I mean, when I give my presentations on this ESSER money, a lot of people on school boards come up to me. Sometimes they wait and they email me afterwards and they tell me, I had no idea. So when people get up and they cry and scream and yell at board members, they need to understand that most of these people on school boards, they don't know about these interim final requirements. They don't know how much their school took. They don't know anything about this. They're just told by their superintendent, this is how you vote, or the school attorney, you know, the district attorney, this is how you vote. We're going to vote on mask. You're going to vote yes. That's all you need to know. And they just
There was a lot of optimism in the midterm, not the midterm, but the interim election when Youngkin in Virginia won and turned the state, you know, very red and the school boards were all tossed out. Mm-hmm. That's kind of false optimism, right? Because the new conservative boards have no power because the federal government owns them.
Yeah. And most of the school board members don't know these things. They don't know. And that's one of the problems because they're just told we're going to vote on this money and it's a giant pile of money. Who's going to say no? I mean, if you look at ESSER 1, 2, and then 3, they basically got all of these school districts hooked like crackheads on Fed money. I mean, who's going to
you just blew my mind for a second there.
Millions of dollars.
Let me ask you this. A school near us, near you and I, is a private all-girls school for 150 years, Harpeth Hall, mm-hmm. is a member of the NAIS, National Association of Independent Schools. I harp on this all the time. People are probably sick of me talking about it, but unfortunately, mm-hmm. they are on the march. All-girls private open school to biological boys. After a pause that they said we were going to reassess because the alumni and more importantly, the donors freaked out, called, said, no, we're the parents. We own the school. We say no. They paused. Everyone kind of thought, okay, good. It'll blow over. It'll go away. This won't happen. Guess what? Pause is over. They did it. Mm-hmm. So I kept wondering, where are the firings? Where are the lawsuits, the resignations and protests? Now I think you're telling me that board that made that decision to pause had no power to actually go against it. They were being told this from above. They may have taken some federal bailout in the last year or two.
I'm sure Harpeth Hall took money. I don't know how much. I haven't looked, but there are sites that you can go to see for private schools. For private schools, it's not ESSER funding. It's called EANS funding. And let me tell you what that is, that stands for. That is EANS. Let me find it in my research here. It's but it's basically EANS funds are for every school that is basically not a public school. So it's private schools.
So like the NAIS, it's only for private schools versus the public, versus NEA and the others. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they had some strings.
Yeah. And whenever people do call me and they want to look up, you know, like the other day I looked up Finley Park, there was a Catholic church that had a food bank associated with it and a private school with about 230 students. And the mom wanted to know, they're not getting ESSER funding and they won't tell us what they're getting and they won't answer any of my questions. So how much money are they getting? Well, this church and the food bank and the school of 230 kids got $63 million in PPP funding and EANS funding. So they raked in, and it says right there that that the loan was basically dismissed, so they don't have to pay it back. I mean, it was a loan; it was considered a loan, but all that money—it was just all the loans.
As long as they comply with the powers of P, you know, Department of Education, the one Betsy DeVos recommended we shutter after serving as its secretary under Trump, sent a letter to Tennessee, which we just talked about. This is a states' right issue, right? I mean, this is not, you said ESEA, and I think that was, became a law in 1965, right? Mm. So here we are, fast forward to now, and these titles and small prints, that's not federalism. That's not what the Constitution said. Why are we not seeing Republican leaders in a Republican state like Tennessee saying no?
Oh, why? Well, it's simple. Yes, because there's a ton of special interest money that comes to them, and you can easily look up who gives your lawmakers money, and you can see how much money comes to them from education lobbies, from you know, the NEA, from all the curriculum developers. They all give money to lawmakers. And if you go in, you can look at any lawmaker in the United States and see who they're taking money from. That's why, because there's just too much money in it. And in Tennessee, especially, they talk a good game, like they're just so conservative. And you notice they only take action on things when it's an election year. And then all the other times, they act like they're just doing these great things for the people, but they pass these ridiculous laws with no teeth. There's absolutely no sanctions. For instance, we passed a law here in Tennessee that you can't teach critical race theory. And they didn't even use the words critical race theory. They were careful to phrase it in a way that just was a blanket statement about anything that was related to critical theory. Okay. They passed that law. So who did they put in charge of deciding whether, if there's a complaint made from a school, like if you're a parent and you know that this garbage is being taught to your children and you file a complaint and say, this is against the law in Tennessee, guess who gets to make the decision about whether that's really a valid report or not? Penny Schwinn.
From California.
Yeah. And here's the thing. There are no sanctions to punish schools for doing this. So the law says don't do it, but the person deciding on the validity of reports is the very person who brought this garbage into our state, appointed by Governor Bill Lee, I might add. And And there are no sanctions or punishments. So schools just basically just tell our legislature and parents to piss off. We're going to do what we want, and there's nothing you can do about it. I got a message this morning from a senator. I won't mention her name, but she was asking me a question about the health department starting a new agency. She was asking me if I would look into it. And I said, wait a minute, the health department falls under the authority of the Joint Government Ops Committee of our legislature. How is
Upside
it
down.
that our Joint Government Ops Committee members don't know about this? And her response is, that's just how they do things now. They just do whatever they want.
Why do we even have elected officials then? They don't do anything. They just let the agencies run wild, and these Fed funds come
I
with
know.
very expensive strings attached. And let me ask you this. What about the Fed funds attached to Vanderbilt Medical and their top and bottom surgeries for hundreds of thousands of dollars? Is there a follow the money angle there too?
We have not followed anything with Vanderbilt, other than just their general treatment of COVID patients if it's related to COVID. But there are some really big heavy hitters, on the trail with all of this terrible gender stuff that's going on. And so that's not been an area where we've worked at all, because there are like Robbie Starbuck and his wife are working on that. And so the, and Matt Walsh is working on that. And so, we really haven't looked into that part of Vanderbilt at all. And we're not going to, because it's, we don't have the bandwidth to fight every battle or look into everything. But I'm sure that, well, they said themselves in videos that there's just, they're making bank doing this to kids.
You're making bank, and if you're a conscientious objector, you have no place here. You should be fired. I don't have a lot of time with you left. I definitely want to have you back. You're fascinating. I really love what you guys are doing with actually following the money and doing the research. I just have a few more questions, and then I'll have to let you
Okay.
go. I know you're deeply into election integrity, right? There's something that I just discovered called Tennessee error. That was found in 98% of the Georgia Dominion voting machines. You probably knew about this all along, but the media just apparently wanted to take a look at it. You have anything to say about this election that's coming up in November, and integrity?
Well, I know that for Tennessee, there were two counties that had Dominion machines, and it was Williamson County and Hamilton County. And I know that the error uncovered in Williamson County during the special election was responsible for getting Dominion removed. But of course, then they put in ES&S, which isn't any better. In fact, they're all of them. But here's a really interesting thing that I learned today in a meeting. I didn't know this. Do you know that most of the states, all of the states, have one, maybe two vendors for voting machines? Do you know that Tennessee has 35?
No, I did not know that.
Yes, I didn't know that either until this
And
morning.
one of them just went
What?
to jail for being a Chinese, was it Kotech? I mean, is that one of the
Well,
35, or are these all pure?
probably. I mean, Tennessee has, 35 different vendors of voting machines.
Well, I
And
know we have 99 counties, so there's a lot to cover, and I could see one
but think
company
about it
not being
though.
able to do it, but that's a lot of companies
But most
just
states
to count votes.
most states have one or two. So
Yeah.
why does Tennessee have 35? That's insane. And here's the problem. None of
A
them
lot of
can
mouths to feed.
properly, none of them can be properly certified. That's the biggest problem. And another thing I learned today that everybody should know is that the Fed is completely embedded in our voting systems, because voting machines were considered a critical infrastructure. So it fell under the Department of Homeland Security. And
Of course.
so even if we wanted the Fed out of our voting elections, out of our elections, out of our processes, we can't, because
Like a tick.
they're considered,
It's
I have
funny. In
no idea.
2005, Jimmy Carter and James Baker, Republican, issued a report with recommendations on maximizing ballot access and election integrity. I think the bad guys use it as a blueprint for how to
Yeah.
do it as opposed to how to protect against it. So we certainly are in a bad way here. I had no idea about that. So thank you so much for telling everybody.
Yeah.
All we need is one Las Vegas style money counting machine to count the votes. Did you vote yes or no, or this guy or that gal? And that's all it would take.
Well,
it's crazy.
Here's our goal. We want to get to the place where we are counting ballots by hand.
Yeah.
And then using scanners to verify. That's our goal. I mean, if we can't get rid of these stupid machines, I mean, 210 years of voting in Tennessee, and we can't do it without machines. I mean, I don't understand that.
We can, and it's a grift. It's a thing. I mean, I wish everyone would go back and listen to my guest, Patrick Kolbeck from Michigan, who was on the ground in 2020 when they were blocking the election observers with pizza boxes. You remember?
He
wrote the book on the stolen election, literally the 2020 coup is what it's called by Senator Kolbeck.
Yeah.
And he exposed all the tricks. Now Heritage.org ranked Tennessee number one for election integrity, but either all 49 are really, really bad and we're just the best of the bad, or they got it wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe it's true. Maybe we are the best, but it seems like we got a problem with elections. Absolutely. So there are four constitutional amendments on the ballot in 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. Are you interested in those? Are you paying any attention to those? Is there some trick to the money game there?
You know, we've looked at a couple of them and some of them we have serious questions about. And right now it's a no for us after
all four.
Yeah. All four right now. I can't remember, I think it's number three that has to do with the prisons and
slavery and indentured servitude. And I know the indentured servitude is the trick.
You know, and here's the question I have about that. You know, they want to pay prisoners for working, but it doesn't, two issues with that. One, it doesn't spell out who gets the money. It doesn't say that the inmate working gets the money. It doesn't say who gets the money. So who gets the money for the prisoner working? That's one of the problems. It's not specific enough to tell you who's getting paid, because if it's CoreCivic, who owns almost all the prisons, if they're the ones getting the money for these prisoners working, no, I don't want to make CoreCivic richer, because they're a corrupt, awful organization.
That's a good way to look at it. And I'm really cynical, where I would think that if they refuse to work for money, they are now a slave and therefore would have a loophole to probably get out early with a good lawyer. But AJ, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. You know, we are nearing the end here. Please tell everyone where they can go to find out more about you and Tennessee Liberty Network, or donate. I know you said you didn't take any money, but this can't be cheap. Well, how can they follow you?
Okay. Yeah, we don't take money ever for anything. We're on Facebook, TN Liberty Network on Facebook, and I'm in Facebook jail for the next 30 days. So sorry, but we've got a good admin, so you can get on Facebook there. We're also on Telegram, and you can find us. We are at TN Liberty Network FB for Facebook, because it's our sister group on Telegram for our Facebook, TN Liberty Network FB, Frank B. And our Atom Group website for our COVID advocacy is theatomgroup.net, and it's theadamgroup.net.
We didn't get into that more deeply, but producer Steve's giving me the signal, so we gotta go, but we'll have you back, I promise. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
God bless.
You too.
This pawn shop ticket for this week's rent. Well, last week's check.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard and anything else on my mind today. Steve, what'd you think of AJ?
Well, I butted in a couple times, and I apologize, Steve. I know this is your show, and sometimes I just get so aggravated over here. I'm just like, I got to say something. So that wasn't appropriate, but I really...
My guess is that the audience does feel the same way, because they heard what they heard, and sometimes it's... gets you activated.
It does. knowing that, I learned a lot more about the different layers of the SR2, SR1, the CARES Act and all that. And I was thinking, is that where that trillions of dollars that got released, it had to be part of that? Or is this actually separate money apart and aside from all the trillions of dollars that Trump released and then Biden released?
I think it's all part of the $31 trillion of debt that America has accumulated since Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. So we are we are down a bad, bad path.
It's called Payola.
It's called Payola. Let's talk about something else for a second. Did you happen to notice that the CDC was going to vote Thursday, we're recording this Wednesday, October 19th, to permanently shield Pfizer and Moderna from vaccine lawsuits?
I actually thought that in all reality, I thought there was already a law in place that said you cannot go after vaccine manufacturers already.
That was for the emergency use only. But the vote today, Wednesday, was 15-0. They voted to add it to the vaccines for children schedule.
Oh.
This is not the childhood vaccine schedule.
Oh.
Happen tomorrow. So that is going to be on the list for things for them to vote on tomorrow. I also want to talk about California Democrat Gavin Newsom signed a new law Thursday night to strip rights away from parents who protest their children's blind pursuit of destructive surgeries sold to confuse minors as gender affirmation. Under Senate Bill 107, introduced by San Francisco area State Senator Scott Wiener, there's that guy again, California will now become a refuge for trans-identifying minors who seek irreversible medical treatment for gender dysphoria. But here's the kicker. If a transgender child from out of state is, let's just say, not allowed to be themselves because of a parent, California somehow legally now can come into that state and remove that child from that parent. What do you think of that?
Are you saying that if a person's living in another state, that they can remove if the child requests asylum?
Yeah. Exactly. California courts will have the power to strip custody from parents wherever they live who doubt the wisdom of these experimental and irreversible procedures. If their child so much as steps foot in California, it would also allow California doctors to treat minors still in other states. With the advent of telehealth, a child could get a prescription for hormones from a California doctor while at home in Arkansas or in Florida.
Wow.
In other news, The dictionary defines racist as a person who believes a particular race is superior to others. It also says a person with a prejudice believes that one race is superior to the others. Let's play that clip of the notable, remarkable Ibram X. Kendi.
He's really understanding the way racism operates. And so I actually define racism as a powerful collection of racist policies that lead to racial inequity and are substantiated by racist ideas. And I define a racist individual as someone who is expressing a racist idea or supporting a racist policy with their actions or even inaction. Is really understood.
So according to him, a noted scholar, millionaire who's sold several books, a racist does racisty, racisty things in a racist, racist way. Okay, very interesting. Let's hear from somebody who actually knows a thing or two. Let's play the next clip.
Tomlin are two of the few black head coaches in the league. I wonder what your relationship is like with them and your thoughts on Steve Wilkes joining that fold.
I have a very good relationship with Tomlin. We don't look at what color we are when we coach against each other. We just know each other. I have a lot of very good white friends that coach in this league as well, and I don't think it's a big deal as far as us being coaching against each other. I think it's normal. Wilkes got an opportunity to do a good job. Hopefully he does it. And we coach ball. We don't look at color.
But you also understand that representation matters too, right? And that when young aspiring coaches or even football players, they see you guys, you know, they see someone that looks like them, maybe grew up like them, that has to mean something.
Well, when you say you see you guys and look like them and grow up like them, means that we're oddballs to begin with. And I think the minute you guys stop making a big deal about it, everybody else will as well.
So, Steve, my question to you is, who's more racist, Ibram X. Kendi or the reporter who asked the coach that question?
I think the reporter who asked that question is just totally racist, if you want to be honest.
I think so, too. Stay tuned for my thought of the week.
I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand how I bring you down.
Welcome to our Pod of the Week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to the Mill Creek View Facebook page, Getter, LinkedIn, Deezer, Spotify, or iHeartRadio, and now iTunes, buddy. Wow. And hit the subscribe button. Thanks for doing it. Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all the time thing. You don't win once in a while. You don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. Winning is a habit. Unfortunately, so is losing. Individual commitment to a group effort, that is what makes a team work, a company work, a society work, a civilization work. That was written by Coach Lombardi, and he's considered by many to be the greatest coach in football history, and he is recognized as one of the greatest coaches and leaders in the history of all American sports. Well, that's it for this episode. Really hope you liked it. Thank you, AJ DePriest, for all you do. Hey, write to me at millcreekview@yahoo.com, and I just might read it on the air. Don't be nasty. The world is mean enough, so don't darken my door with your nonsense. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, Managing Director of Mill Creek Financial Partners, begging for peace in our time.
Children and the pumpkins at the county fair. They were looking for America.